From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We've been talking a lot about Pope Leo XIV on this show. Maybe everybody's been talking about Pope Leo, but being a Chicago guy, a White Sox fan myself, I've been particularly excited about this new pope and been following everything that he does. We'll be so excited to check in with him, with Brett Thoman, who is there living in Rome. He's a Catholic author. He's actually written some episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter as a script writer, and he was there in Rome when the announcement came, when the white smoke came out, and he was able to witness Pope Leo XIV stepping out on the balcony for the first time. So we're going to get a firsthand perspective of his reflections on that. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Jonathan Jerome, the executive director of the National Shrine of St. Rita, talking to us about that incredible saint right around her feast day. And people can check out my series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, if they go to EWTN On Demand, or they tune into EWTN Television on Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time every week. There's a new episode, and this week they're doing the episode on Explore London. I'll be exploring historic London and walking in the footsteps of St. Thomas Becket, whose remarkable life and heroic death were followed with an overflowing of grace and miraculous events. So check that one out, Explore London, this Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also check out my series, They Might Be Saints, where I look at the Americans on the path to sainthood and the search for canonization miracles. And for this week, I investigate the canonization cause of Mother Mary Therese Dudzik, a Polish immigrant who founded her own order of nuns to take care of the poor, elderly, and abandoned in Chicago. And for those people who want to go beyond just watching my shows on television, but would actually like to go to experience how these shows are made, you can come with me on a pilgrimage. I'm going to on a Jubilee year pilgrimage to Italy, to Milan, Turin, Florence, and Rome. And we're there for the canonization of Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati. And the dates for that are July 28th and to August 4th, 2025. That's this year, of course. And we've had a few new signups this week. So you can sign up at pilgrimages.com/miraclehunter to join us on this trip where we go to places of saints and miracles. And we'll see sites of Marian apparitions in Italy and visit the Duomo in Milan. We'll visit Turin to see the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist, where the Shrine of Turin is held, and walk in the footsteps of Pier Giorgio and the places where St. John Bosco had his famous visions. And we'll go to Florence, home to many great artists, of course, and see that David there. And we'll also go to a site of the Marian apparition of Mary to the Servites, the holy founders of the Servites. We'll finish up in Rome to see the many incredible sites around the Vatican and finish with the canonization of one of the great modern saints. That's Pier Giorgio Frassati, and that is July 28th through August 4th. You can go to pilgrimages.com/miraclehunter to find out more and to sign up. Later in the show, we're going to be looking at the might-be saint of the day. For today's day, we've got Blessed Maria Gargani from Italy and the 365 Days with Mary project, where we look at a Marian devotion of the day. For today's day, we've got the Mother of God from Belarus in the 14th century. And the question of the week: why did Pope Leo mention the miraculous icon of Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii in his first address? And the miracle of the day, in 1608, we have the Eucharistic miracle of Favernay in France. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening all around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And we're actually going to stay on the same topic as last week's miracle news item, which was the image in India on a Eucharistic host has been recognized as an authentic miracle. And so, of course, we have this news coming through various news outlets, but just last week, Zenit, which is one of the most reputable Vatican sources of information, came out with a statement that we have the Vatican approval of this this miraculous image appearing on a host. And, of course, we are looking forward to seeing that document when it comes out on May 31st. But the archbishop there, he attended the parish where this small rural church was tucked in the hills of Kerala. That's in southern India. And this image has caused quite a stir in 2013 and beyond, this image of the face of Christ on a consecrated Eucharistic host. And I don't know the details. I don't know what they're saying the image is made of or how it appears. And I do not know if this is going to be a statement from the Pope himself. You might remember when we reviewed the case of the change of the new document, 2024, we saw the new norms for proceeding and judging alleged private revelations. In that document, it says that the Vatican will no longer release statements of supernaturality except when the Pope wants to. So the question is, will the Vatican will be releasing a statement that this was a supernatural event, or will they just be saying nihil obstat, nothing stands in the way, that the faithful can believe what they want to believe, and there's no harm in doing so? And of course, in the case of Eucharistic miracles of Legnica in Poland and Sokolka in Buenos Aires and Tixla in Mexico, we have these cases of true flesh and true blood manifest on a Eucharistic host. But in this particular case, there is not blood, at least according to the early reports. So perhaps there is less scientific analysis on this one, and they will just release a nihil obstat. I'll be so excited to hear the news of when this comes out on May 31st, and you'll be the first to know. I'll certainly announce it on this show, what the Vatican has said with regards to the miracle happening in Villa Kanur in India. Stay tuned for that one. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize for an emailer that writes in the fastest with the correct answer. Last week, we talked about how Pope Leo XIV, he has a lot of Roman numerals behind his name, and we wondered which pope has the highest Roman numeral of any pope in history. I think that's kind of a funny question, but anyway, it's the question. So which pope had the highest number? And that answer is, of course, John the 23rd. He's the one with the biggest number behind his name. Thanks for everyone who wrote in with that correct answer. And another question about the Pope this week. We're staying on the theme of the Pope with this new Pope having come to us. And so the question for this week is, what is the name of the ring worn by the Pope? So they give him a special ring. What is the name of that ring? If you think you know that answer, you want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or questions@miraclehunter.com, and we'll see if you have the answer. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Catholic author Brett Thoman about his experience of witnessing the election of Pope Leo XIV. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who've tuned into this show know that I was in Rome very recently for Easter, and I was there for the planned canonization of Carlo Acutis. We still don't know the date of that one, but of course, we went to Easter Sunday Mass, and then the next morning we heard the news there in Rome that Pope Francis had passed away. And that was an incredible time to be there in Rome, and being there at his funeral was also a monumental thing. I was so grateful to be there at that time. But, of course, I did have the secret wish that I could stay through the conclave and find out who the next pope was going to be and be there in the crowd for that incredible moment when the curtain opens and the Pope walks out and addresses the faithful for the first time. I think it's truly, truly amazing. And I would have especially liked it, given that our new Pope, Pope Leo XIV, is from the Chicago area, as am I. I'm a Chicago guy. So that would have been extra sweet to have been there. But, of course, I've watched the coverage and I've been as excited as anybody about the potential for this new pope. And so, but we do have somebody, a great friend of the show and author of some of the episodes of Explore with the Miracle Hunter, and that's Brett Thoman. You might know him as a Catholic author and pilgrimage leader. His most recent book, Complete Pilgrimage Guide to Italy, is a great one for anyone who goes. I know when I went to Rome this past time, I had his book with me. So I encourage people to check that one out. Welcome back to the show today, Brett.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, so you were lucky. You were one of the lucky ones to be in the crowd there for when we all got a look at Pope Leo XIV for the very first time. There weren't many American flags flying in that crowd that I saw, so being an American in that crowd was amazing.
I wish I had had one. Oh, yeah, it was exhilarating.
Talk a little bit about the run-up to it. I know that you're normally stationed in Assisi, and were you camped out in Rome, or what was going on with your schedule, or how did you work it out that you could make that happen?
Yeah, so this was just the second day of the conclave, the voting part of the conclave, and I live in Loreto, which is on the Adriatic Sea. It's basically the opposite side of the peninsula from Rome. I'm about an hour and 20 minutes or so from Assisi, which is pretty centrally located along the peninsula, and then Rome's another hour and a half after that. But I really, really wanted to go down there, and you know, I've been here in Italy for 10 years, and this is the first conclave we've had since I've been here. And it's really, you know, now that popes are living longer and longer, conclaves are really kind of getting spaced farther and farther apart, right? Before, you know, a century or so ago, people would live maybe, you know, in their elderly age, once they're elected a pontiff, five, six, 7 years, sometimes less. Now they're living 10 to 15, even 20 years. So I figured not it's a once in a life opportunity to go, but I don't know when the next one will be. So I wanted to go the first day, but we just kind of let it go. Okay, it was bright. I think it was Thursday when the afternoon they came on, they did the one or two votes or something, and then there's the black smoke. But I said to my wife, Katya, I said, you know, tomorrow I really want to go down to Rome and I really want to be part of this. I was fully expecting just to see black smoke, right? And so she said, well, if you're going, I'm going too. And she had the day off work, and then our 7-year-old son came with us also. So the three of us went down. Like I said, it's a little over a three-hour drive. So we got there a little after 12 o'clock, and as we were walking in, we had just missed the black smoke for the two morning votes. And that was okay. It was really kind of a festive atmosphere. Just there's a lot of excitement in the air. And, you know, Rome is busy. Well, any time of the year, but now with, you know, you mentioned Easter, you mentioned the
the security around Rome at that time was immense when I was there. So I
there's a lot going on.
The streets are gummed up as well.
There's a Jubilee. Yeah, the Jubilee also. So it was going to be crowded, but there was something different in the air, just kind of a sense of excitement. So we got in there just after the black smoke, but that was okay. We went, I met a few people that I knew that were there. Had some lunch, came back in about 3:30, and we just kind of camped out in the square at that point. The line wasn't too bad to get in because people were expecting the smoke around 5 or 6 or something. Mm-hmm. So we got in, and we were just literally standing there. It was a little hot, so we went behind the shadow that was cast by the obelisk. It was this long strip of shade, probably about 8 feet across and maybe 40 feet long, and there's all these people lined up under that. There's some American priests in front of us. So I just started talking with them, and there was another American woman and her daughter. Her daughter just finished up a study abroad program in Rome, so the mom came, and I think they were Catholics, so they were there. So people kind of all, and lots of Italians. So here's what happened, Michael. So it was about 6 o'clock, a little before 6, and we had parked my car in a parking lot that was going to close at 7, which was, you know, we had to take some public transportation to get out there, so we said, let's go back. Well, you know, we leave now, we'll be home at 9 o'clock. So he said bye to the priest, bye to the people. We're walking out. We got into a taxi, and as we're driving out away from the area of St. Peter's, this was like the Via Aurelia area, my wife, who's very intuitive, she starts noticing just kind of an energy in the cars and people around us. People were like running, starting to run towards St. Peter's. She saw that, and she said, did they elect a pope? And I said, I doubt it. So I opened up my phone. And sure enough, they said a new pope has been elected, white smoke. So I told the taxi driver, I said, turn around, go back, go back. We were yelling, and he was one of those typical Romans. He didn't seem to be that interested, didn't really seem to care all that much. But he took us back, and maybe because he lost a fare, I don't know. We only paid him €5. That's as far as we went. Then we ran back into the square, and the bells started ringing, and there was just this sort of mad rush towards the square. People of all ages were running. I was running. My 7-year-old son, he was running too. And my wife was behind us. She was keeping up. So we got back in through the metal detectors. And by that point, it was pretty crowded. And so we found a little spot. And then it was about an hour went by between when the smoke came up until the first, you know, the first movement up on the balcony, and the Pope steps out. First, the Chamberlain, I think it's called, Camerlengo, steps out, makes the announcement, and the Pope comes out. So about an hour went by, and I was, again, talking with people standing around us. I heard some Americans, they were behind us talking to. And then there was this Italian journalist who was kind of walking around. He was just sort of interviewing people at random. And I said, hey, I'm American. This was before the Pope had been announced. I said, I'm American. My wife's Italian. So he said a few things to him. He was working for the RAI, the main Italian network. So anyway, we get there, and then they had these four maxi, you know, huge screens, and, you know, strategically placed around the square. So you could kind of see up close, which was nice they had put that up. And then there's a very loud speaker. So the cardinal comes out. He makes the announcement in Latin. And I'm familiar with the formula a little bit, and I was really waiting for it. And, oh, by the way, just earlier in the day, I had given an interview on Seize the Day with Gus Lloyd. And we were in, right when I was in there, about a couple hours before the white smoke came out, we were talking about this, and he asked me what I thought about, could there be an American Pope? I said, there could be, but I don't think there will be. And so we went down, and we started talking about the three or four kind of papabili, you know, the hopeful, papal hopefuls. And we actually talked about Prevost. And I had heard the name. I thought he had been in diplomacy, but he, you know, we know the story, been a missioner down in Peru. So we talked about him. So his name, Robert Prevost, was fresh on my mind. So when the Chamberlain announced the name Roberto, they do it in Latin, Roberto Franciscus Prevost, I heard Prevost, and it was so quiet all around me, and I just instinctively yelled out, I shouted out, I said, Prevost, Americano, Americano, I think he's an American, he's American. And it was so quiet, and all you could hear was me yelling. My wife kind of nudged me with her elbow, she's like, be quiet. I said, they just elected American, I can't be quiet. And oh my gosh, it was so exciting. And then the journalist in front of me, he kind of, you know, he heard me yell, obviously, so he turned around, and he assumed at that point I kind of knew something about what was happening, or at least the papables, because he didn't know who Prevost was. And I said, if they just said Prevost, he's an American. And then he had his phone open, and he was kind of going through his feed. And I was so excited when he said Prevost, I didn't hear what they said after that, which is the name that he took. Mm-hmm. And the way it comes out in Latin is Leone Decimo e Quarto. So it's like 10 plus 4. They don't have a word for 14 in Latin. They have to say 10 plus 4. So it's, you know, Leone 10 plus 4, and that kind of confused people. But he had his feed open, so instantly he saw. He said, yeah, Robert Prevost, American, took the name Leo the 14th. Because I had heard also Franciscus, which is his middle name, which is Francis. It's Robert Francis Prevost. And I heard Franciscus, and I thought that he had taken the name Francis the II. But that wasn't the case. So, yeah, it was so exciting, and I said, oh, my gosh, they just said Prevost. And I confirmed with a journalist. I said, did he say Prevost? He said, yeah, I sure did. He said, "That's yeah, you got an American Pope. And I said, oh, my God, I can't believe it. So I was just smiling ear to ear. Everybody around me, and they were kind of quiet because they didn't know who he was. Most of the people were Italian around me. And then I turned around to the Americans behind me in the group, and I said, which one of you are American? We got an American Pope right now. And they said, oh, my gosh. So it was just, it was so exciting. And this might sound like a stretch, but that night, for some reason, I kind of felt like, almost like I did when I got married, just like really hopeful for the future. Like, I'm kind of on a new path, and I feel that way still right now with Pope Leo. I think we're on a good path. The fact that he's an American. Oh, and then when he came out on the balcony and he started speaking Italian, he's got an American accent, and that's my son, he's 7 years old, and he goes to the Italian schools here in Italy, but he also knows English, and he said, Dad, he talks just like you, because I have an American accent when I speak Italian, and then the new Pope is speaking, so when I hear him speak in Italian, it's like, my gosh, he speaks just like me. So it was just, again, it's just exhilarating. I'm so grateful I got to be there, and it was luck. You know, maybe some providence, maybe some grace, but I got down there. And we did miss the white smoke, so I didn't get to see the smoke. I didn't get to see the black smoke or the white smoke, but I got to see the first American Pope step out on the balcony, and I'll never forget.
That's amazing that you picked up that it was Prevost, an American, having just talked about him recently. I had the same experience, obviously, far away. I watched it from Chicago, and I had just been with the Augustinians at Villanova. And so they
you
had
were
been
in
talking.
Chicago?
Yeah, I'm from Chicago, and I was with the Augustinians from Villanova the previous Monday. And they were talking about Prevost, and I thought, wow, this is, you know, I didn't really know about him, and here they are. Yeah. They're really pumping him up, saying that he could be the next pope, and I had the same idea. Could an American ever be pope? But when I heard the word, the name Prevost, amidst all the Latin, I said, we've got an American pope. So amazing experience to be there in person, I'm sure.
It was amazing. And then he just, he looked so good in his you know, his white papal garb. It just, I don't know, it just seemed to fit him so well. And he stood there so well poised. I said, man, this guy was really picked to be the pope. He's just, he's great. And his Latin was impeccable. The prayer he sang, the Regina Coeli, which was so beautiful. It was just, no, that actually, I take that back. That was on Sunday during the Angelus. I turned on the 12 o'clock Angelus on Sunday to watch him. And he sang the Regina Coeli, which was, he sung beautifully. So I'm real excited about this, and I'm learning about him. I just downloaded the Confessions by St. Augustine on my cell phone because he's already talking. And then Sunday at Mass, the priest at our homily and during his homily mentioned St. Augustine like two times. So I think we're going to be kind of in for an Augustinian future, which I have to confess, I don't know a whole lot about the Augustinians and their spirituality, you know, their mendicant order about the time of St. Francis, because I'm a Third Order Franciscan, but I know a lot about St. Francis, but St. Augustine, I'm going to have to pick up a little bit on that. So, but I'm really hopeful. I think we're, I just feel like a lot of good things are about to come out of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of hope, and we're praying and we're learning as we go about this brand new Pope, Pope Leo XIV. We've been talking today about with Brett Thoman about his experience of being there in person to witness the election of Pope Leo XIV. He's, of course, a Catholic author, including his newest book, Complete Pilgrimage Guide to Italy. It's one that I've used myself, and I highly recommend it. Now, Brett, you've also written for Explore with the Miracle Hunter, a number of episodes for me. We're grateful for your great writing work for that. And one of the episodes that you did was related to Pompeii, Our Lady of Pompeii, Our Lady of the Rosary. And in his first address, when he was elected, he came out on the balcony and spoke in Latin and Italian and Spanish. And he kind of referenced his Marian devotion, or entrusted his papacy to Mary. And one of the names very specifically he said was Our Lady of Pompeii, which you know, I think that was, you know, that was surprising to me that he had a very specific Marian title that he was interested in, and of course an Italian one, and one that Pope Leo XIII had a great devotion or connection to. Talk a little bit about Our Lady of Pompeii and what it might mean to Pope Leo to mention it like that.
Sure, Michael. Yeah, great question. Well, I think the main reason is because May 8th was and is the feast of Our Lady of Pompeii, and that is the day that Pope Leo XIV was elected pope. So in honor of that liturgical feast, he led a Hail Mary from the balcony when he presented himself and introduced himself to the people of Rome and then to the world. So, and he mentioned Our Lady of Pompeii specifically, so he has a devotion to Our Lady. And Our Lady of Pompeii goes back to a layperson who's been beatified, not yet canonized, but he's beatified. He was a Third Order Dominican. His name was Bartolo Longo. He's a very interesting story. So if you don't know much about him, your listeners, I highly recommend looking him up, because he was very anti-Catholic during the 19th century with Illuminism and rationalism and all that. He was a law student. He actually dabbled in Satanism for a little bit too. But then he had a strong, powerful conversion centered on the Rosary, centered on Our Lady. So he moved to Pompeii and noticed that there, which is famous for the archaeological ruins, but he moved there and noticed that there was a lot of superstition and a lot of kind of devotions to amulets and that kind of thing. So he started organizing these rosary recitals, and then he wanted to have more devotion to Our Lady. So in Naples, he found this image of Our Lady, kind of a Dominican image, because Our Lady is handing a rosary to Saints Dominic and St. Catherine of Siena. And he took that, bought it. It was sort of dilapidated, so he restored it, put it in a chapel, and then expanded the chapel into a larger church, which became a sanctuary, and then actually a papal basilica. So very devoted to Our Lady. And he also wrote a long novena, longer than 9 days. I forget exactly how many days it is. But it's called the Devotion to Our Lady of Pompeii. Many miracles and graces have been associated with this devotion. And then to kind of steer it back to Pope Leo XIV and Leo XIII, it was actually Pope Leo XIII who designated that very basilica, that sanctuary in Pompeii, designated it, made it a papal basilica. So Pope Leo XIII was very devoted to Our Lady, and I think that Pope, it's clear that Pope Leo XIV is, since he mentioned Our Lady of Pompeii, prayed a rosary out on the balcony as he introduced himself. And so I think it remains to be seen the connection that he wants to establish and draw between not just Leo XIII, but there was Leo the Great, Leo I, back in the when the church was being overrun by the barbarians. A lot of Pope Leos did a lot of great things for the church. So I'm very hopeful for this papacy, and I'm praying a lot for Pope Leo daily, and I really hope for good things.
We're so grateful to you, Brett Thoman, for joining us on today's program, talking to us about Pope Leo XIV and Our Lady of Pompeii, and check out his book, Complete Pilgrimage Guide to Italy. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. I love traveling around the country and giving talks at various shrines or parishes or conferences. And I always talk about miracles, of course. I talk for about 45 minutes about how the church investigates the supernatural or the history of Marian apparitions or Eucharistic miracles, how they're investigated. And I always leave a little time for questions and answers. And I always like hearing what people are thinking about. And so I always answer as long as people have questions at the end of the night. And that's always my favorite part. But people can actually invite me to speak at their parish if they go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and click on the contact tab. You can send me a message that way. And maybe I'll be speaking sometime in an area near you. And so for this week's question, and people send me emails as well to questions@miraclehunter.com. And this was one that came in over email. It says, Dear Miracle Hunter, why did Pope Leo mention the miraculous icon of Our Lady of Pompeii in his first address? Thank you, Timothy. Well, thanks, Timothy, for that great question. And there's a very simple answer to this. I think that we've seen that the Pope going to Genazzano, we talked about that last week, and that's connected to the Augustinian order, that famous icon of the Mother of Good Counsel is the image of that order, that order venerates especially. But when it comes to Our Lady of Pompeii, Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii, there's a very simple reason. And of course, this is a very famous Italian icon in Pompeii. It's a beautiful basilica there. The 54-day Rosary Novena stems from this devotion, the healing of Fortuna Agrelli with a Marian apparition as a result of praying to Mary under this title. So it's quite possible that we see Pope Leo with a special devotion, especially considering Pope Leo XIII, his predecessor, approved that 54-day Rosary Novena and had that devotion himself. However, there's much more of a simplistic explanation as to why the Pope mentioned the name of Our Lady of the Rosary of Pompeii. It's because, well, he was elected on her feast day. So thanks, Timothy, for that great question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary Project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. And for today's date, we've got the Mother of God from Zyrowiecki in Belarus in the 14th century. And we all know these different Marian devotions around the world, whether it be Our Lady of Fatima on May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion from each day all around the world. And we're talking about the building of basilicas, the occurring of miracles, the feast days, and other ways to celebrate Mary in a big way everywhere around the world. And so for today's date, we've got the Mother of God from Zyrowiecki in Belarus in the 14th century. And the story goes that one night around the year 1500, some herders noticed a wild pear tree radiating a light from a small jasper oval carved of a woman and child in the Eleusa, or tenderness style, of icon. in the Slavonic inscription of the Magnificat in the Orthodox liturgy. More honorable than the cherubim, more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. In virginity you bore God the Word. True Mother of God, we magnify you. The herders took it to the landlord, Alexander Sultan, who put it in a chest, but it reappeared in the forest, and Sultan built a wooden church there that burned down years later. Some children passing the spot saw a radiant woman holding the stone icon, and when a priest came, she had vanished, but the icon remained on that rock where she sat. And that is today's devotion, the Mother of God from Zirovichi in Belarus in the 14th century. For more information on this fascinating devotion, or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can connect to the project, 365dayswithmary.com. You can pick up the book or download the app or connect to the Facebook page and join any of 10,000 other followers who check out 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at the miracle of the day. Each day, each week, we try to find a miracle that occurred on that day's date at some point in Christian history, somewhere around the world. And so a notable Catholic miracle happened on May 24th, 1608, and it was a Eucharistic miracle of Favrenay in France. On the eve of Pentecost, the monks at the Benedictine monastery in Favrenay prepared a three-day exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. And during the night, a fire broke out, consuming the altar and its surroundings, and miraculously, the monstrance containing the consecrated host was found suspended in midair, untouched by the flames, and remained so for 30 hours. The event was witnessed by many and was later recognized by church authorities as a genuine Eucharistic miracle. And that's today's miracle of the day for May 24th. We've got the Eucharistic miracle of Favrenay in France in the year 1608. Each week we talk about the sainthood news, of course. We do this every week, where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood, and that lines up to my projects on television. They might be saints. In my book, they might be saints, available from EWTNRC.com. And when we talk about the sainthood news, of course, we try to give you those saints who are coming down the pipeline. But unfortunately, we're in a slight pause mode because we have a new pope, and it takes a new pope in order to meet with the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, where they promulgate new decrees regarding the new saints coming forward, or the venerables, the blessed, the saints. And Pope Leo hasn't gotten to that yet. You might see his schedule. It's quite full, where he's meeting with leaders all around the world about and various other people. And I think that when Pope Leo meets with the head of the Dicastery for the Cause of Saints, he will be naming his first saints as pope, which will be an exciting time for this show and for Catholics around the world. So for now, we don't have any news for Sainthood News, but we'll tune in again next week and see if there are some new ones. Each week, we also talk about the might-be saint of the day. And that's somebody from the day's date whose death anniversary or feast day lines up. And for today's date, we have Blessed Maria Gargani from Italy, of course. And she was the youngest of eight children born in Rocco Gargani, or to Rocco Gargani and Angelino de Paola. And hers was a pious family, and her father made sure the children learned their faith. And they were educated in Mora de Sanctis in Avellino in Italy, and she earned a bachelor's degree in the Secular Franciscan Order in 1914 and developed a deep devotion to St. Francis of Assisi. She taught catechism to children, helped them prepare for First Communion. She even purchased a projector, a great novelty for that time, to display images to explain the life of Christ. And she was a member of the Catholic Action. In August of 1916, she became the first, the spiritual student of St. Padre Pio. And he was not only her spiritual director, but they became friends and correspondents over letters for 50 years. She taught in Volturara, Apulia, in Italy from 1928 to 45, and she received diocesan permission to form a new congregation of women based at a former convent of Santa Maria della Sanita. And these women became the core of the Sisters of the Apostles of the Sacred Heart, founded in 1936, and they moved to Naples. And in 1945, they made the profession. Blessed Maria took the name of Sister Maria Crocifissa of Divine Love. And from 46 until her retirement, Sister Maria taught in Naples, worked to spread the work of the sisters, and Pope John the 23rd gave the sisters full approval on March 12, 1963. They continue their good work even to this day. And, of course, she was born in December 1892 in Ventino, but she died in Italy in Naples in 1973 on May 23rd. And she was declared, her virtues declared, making her a venerable in 2017 by Pope Francis. And then in 2018, just 1 year later, less than a year later even, a miracle involving the healing of Michelina Fornicelli of Torrecusa in Italy. That was the miracle that was recognized in Naples that led to her beatification in 2018 by Pope Francis. And that is the Might Be Saint of the Day, Blessed Maria Gargani from Italy. And for people interested in checking out my series, They Might Be Saints, you can go to the website, theymightbesaints.com. You can check out my series, They Might Be Saints, which airs each week on EWTN television. And for this week, we've got Mother Mary Teresa Dujic from Chicago. And I investigate the canonization cause of Mother Mary Teresa Dujic, a Polish immigrant who founded her own order of nuns to care for the poor, the elderly, and the abandoned. And that'll be coming up this week on EWTN television. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, The Miracle Hunter continues. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to The Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Well, May 22nd is the feast day of St. Rita of Cascia. I was just in Cascia a couple weeks ago. I was in Italy for Easter and what turned out to be the funeral of Pope Francis. But that was an incredible trip, which included a trip to the beautiful shrine of St. Rita of Cascia. And this is the 125th year of her canonization. And in the 100-year anniversary of the centenary, St. John Paul II described her as Rita interpreted well the feminine genius by living it intensely in both physical and spiritual motherhood. There was a quote from the Saint John Paul II. Well, we're so excited today because in light of this feast day, in the United States here, we have a national shrine as well dedicated to St. Rita of Cascia. And we're joined by the executive director, and that's Jonathan Jerome. Welcome to the program today, Jonathan.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me, and happy feast day.
Yes, thank you so much. Happy feast day to you as well. And I think one of the very interesting things as we talk about your shrine and about St. Rita is the now apparent Pope Leo connection, with Pope Leo having come from Villanova right there in your backyard, your neighborhood. Tell us a little bit about how Pope Leo and St. Rita can connect.
Yeah, isn't it wonderful? So as you mentioned, it's the 125th anniversary of St. Rita's canonization. And she was canonized by Pope Leo XIII in the year 1900. So when our new Holy Father took the name Leo XIV, we were ecstatic because he's Augustinian, and the Augustinians have been at the shrine since our foundation. We are an Augustinian shrine, an Augustinian mission. And he took the name Leo XIV. So what a neat connection to the founding of St. Rita's sainthood, to her canonization. You know, the story we tell about the shrine is that our cornerstone was laid in 1907, and so we're one of the first churches anywhere in the world named in her honor because she was canonized just 7 years prior. There are a couple others that are out there, but so neat that here we are celebrating the Jubilee year. We're celebrating this 125th anniversary of canonization, and now we're celebrating our new Pope and his namesake and the connection that we have here, both as an Augustinian institution, and as a Leo. So very, very cool.
Wonderful. We're talking today with Jonathan Jerome about St. Rita of Cascia and that shrine there in the Philadelphia area, the national shrine. And for people who don't know St. Rita, what would you say are the things that the pilgrims who go there connect with her? How would you describe her to the faithful?
Absolutely. You know, there are few saints in our Catholic tradition that have lived every state of life. So she was a daughter, and she got married, and she was a wife, and then she lost her husband to violence, and so she was a widow. She was a mother, and so she obviously understood what motherhood entailed, and then lost her sons to a pandemic. And then she was rejected by society largely. She was ostracized for having lost her husband and her sons. And then in the midst of sort of the turmoil that she experienced, she was a peacemaker, and she was able to bring two different factions of society together to build peace. And then she eventually entered religious life. You know, and so when we look at the rich tapestry of the communion of saints, Saint Rita is one of those saints that lived every vocation, and so she really understands us. You know, one thing we tell people when they come here is, you know, whether it is a mother who's struggling with her teenage boys, Rita was in that situation before, or maybe it's a young person who's struggling with her parents, right? She knew exactly what it was like to have overbearing parents at times. And people who are discerning their vocation, and people who feel very content in their vocation, and people who have lost a loved one, Rita lived every state of life, and so she is someone that can really respond to whatever it is that people might be facing or going through. You know, she shares with St. Jude, the patron saint of impossible cases. That's one of her titles. And so people come from all over because whether it's big or small, each of us can identify something in our lives that oftentimes feels impossible. And Rita, who faced a lot of seemingly impossible moments, was able to overcome those things through perseverance and faith, dedication to prayer. And so she continues to inspire people from every walk of life, from all over the world, to continue to persevere no matter where you are, no matter where you find yourself.
Very well put. We're talking today with Jonathan Jerome about St. Rita of Cassia, with her feast day upon us, and we're talking about the St. Rita of Cassia Shrine in the Philadelphia area. And for miracle-minded Catholics, we might say there are various miracles associated with St. Rita, including that partial stigmata, that small wound on her forehead, or her incorruptible body, or various other miracles that have been associated with her life. So quite an amazing saint. And for those people who want to know more about your shrine, the St. Rita of Cassia Shrine, the National Shrine, from what I've read, it originated from a stable turned into a parish church. Is that true?
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. So at the turn of the century, there was a large influx of Irish and Italian immigrants coming to the United States, coming through the Delaware Valley, and they settled here in South Philadelphia. And they didn't have a lot of money, but they had great faith, and they had a desire to express that faith. And they were able to do that through the skills they possessed. So what happened was through the good efforts of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia, through the good efforts of the Augustinian province of St. Thomas of Villanova, this parish church was founded right on Broad Street. And to give your listeners a little bit of context who aren't familiar with Philadelphia, you know, so Philadelphia is the sixth largest city in the United States, and Broad Street is the main thoroughfare that goes through the city. So, you know, when you hear the news stories of, you know, after the Eagles win the Super Bowl and people are climbing light poles, that's Broad Street. And there's only one Catholic church on all of Broad Street, and that's the National Shrine of St. Rita of Cassia. And so, you know, 118 years ago, when that cornerstone was laid, it was just, they were just looking to build a church that honored God, that rivaled the churches that they were coming from in Italy. And they established this beautiful parish that, with the ebbs and flows of society, with the ebbs and flows of need in South Philadelphia and this area, it grew and then it shrunk and then it fell on hard times and then it grew again. You know, but the devotion to St. Rita and her story was pretty consistent. And so at the sort of points of decision that had to be made, you know, do we keep the parish open? Do we proceed in a different way? Our founding director, Father Michael DiGregorio, suggested, you know, because devotion is so strong to St. Rita, what would it look like if we established this national shrine? And so for about 30 years now, we've existed as a national shrine, honoring St. Rita of Cassia, honoring the life and the legacy and the virtues that she lived so well. And so we do that, you know, sort of from humble beginnings, but we still see the need for, as we talked about, the story that she left us, and we really see the beauty of being in the thick of the city life, and what culture has to offer. You know, we talk about miracles. One thing I might add is when people come here, especially when people come here because they feel like something in their life feels impossible, they often will light a candle, they'll write a prayer intention, they'll spend time praying our novena prayers, whatever the case might be. And the stories that we get, you know, Rita was such a woman of grace upon grace upon grace that she continues to be an intercessor for so many of our people. You know, so for example, we had 150 high school boys, sophomores here, for a retreat earlier this year. So that in and of itself feels impossible. But when they were here, we had a penance service, and one of the teachers came up to us after the penance service with tears in his eyes because a student that he had had some trouble with in class went to confession, and through the guidance of the confessor and through the prayers that were prayed and through the penance that was offered, he came up to the teacher and apologized for the way he'd been acting. You know, and we oftentimes think that miracles have to be something sort of bigger than our own imagination. But even in those small moments where grace and the impossible feels a little more possible, that's God at work. And that's here. It happens through the intercession of St. Rita quite often.
Amazing. We've been talking today with Jonathan Jerome about St. Rita of Cascia and the National Shrine in the Philadelphia area there. And for people in Pennsylvania, perhaps the East Coast, maybe people across the nation who would like to visit your shrine, tell us how they would find it, and then also what would they encounter when they set foot on your shrine?
Absolutely. So the best way to learn about the National Shrine of St. Rita of Cascia is to visit us online. And when you come to the homepage of our website, three simple words that echo St. John Paul II are found right there on the page. Come and see. Come and see. And that's what we invite people to do, to come and see, to visit the shrine, visit our website, visit the resources we have. You know, if you're interested in bringing a pilgrim group, there's a form online you can fill out to give us a heads up that you're coming. We offer retreat days. We offer pilgrimages and tours. There's a full gift shop filled with St. Rita devotional items. There's a beautiful little saint's grotto that we've instituted. One part of Rita's life, when she was sort of down and out and she was really struggling the most, she turned to her own patron saints, St. Augustine, St. Nicholas of Tolentine, and St. John the Baptist, and prayed for their intercession and their help. And so the role of the saints, especially here at the shrine, is a powerful one. And so there's this little saint's grotto we have with 308 different relics of different saints, a lot of Augustinians, but also a lot of popular saints that people seem to gravitate toward. We have that here. We have a beautiful Blessed Sacrament chapel where adoration is offered on a regular basis. Confession is offered every day, twice a day. So all this information can be found on our website, saintsritashrine.org. And saint is spelled out. But I would say go there, just look around, see what intrigues you, see what programs are happening. And then wherever you're coming from, come and visit. Come and see. I guarantee you won't be disappointed. We are in the thick of the city. So, you know, one of the things we often joke about is it can be impossible to find parking. But we'll work with you. We'll see what we can do. We don't want anything to be an obstacle to experiencing the intercession of St. Rita and really the mercy and love that God has to offer each of us. So check us out online and then come visit and come spend a day with us. We'd love to have you.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Jonathan Jerome, Executive Director of the St. Rita of Cascia Shrine, the National Shrine in the Philadelphia area. Thank you so much for joining us on today's program, and happy feast day of St. Rita.
Thanks so much, Michael. Thank you. Happy feast day. God bless.
God bless. That was Jonathan Jerome. A great interview, a great discussion of the life of St. Rita of Cascia and the beautiful shrine, the National Shrine there in the Philadelphia area. People can go to saintritashrine.org. for more information and to schedule your visit. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Brett Thoman, joining us to talk about his experience of the election of Pope Leo XIV, and Jonathan Jerome telling us about that great saint, St. Rita of Cascia, and the National Shrine in the Philadelphia area. Check out my series, Explore with the Miracle Hunter, this week. An episode of Explore London airs, where I explore historic London and walk in the footsteps of St. Thomas Becket, whose remarkable life and heroic death were followed with an overflowing of grace and miraculous events. That airs on Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And for those people who want to go out beyond watching the programs on television but want to join a Jubilee Year pilgrimage, I'll be going to Italy July 28th to August 4th. I'll be going to Rome, Milan, Florence, and Turin. And we'll see Marian apparition sites in Italy, visit the Duomo in Milan. We'll visit Turin to see the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist, where the Shroud of Turin is held. And we'll walk in the footsteps of Pier Giorgio Frassati and see the place where St. John Bosco had his famous visions. And we'll go to Florence and see all that great art. We'll go as well to the site of an apparition of the Virgin Mary to the holy founders of the Servites. and we'll finish up in Rome to see the incredible sights of Rome, the holy doors around the Vatican, and finish with the canonization of one of the great modern saints, that's Pier Giorgio Frassati. You can find out more and sign up at pilgrimages.com/miraclehunter. We had a few signups this past week. Join us if you are able. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter. We're from Claims of Healings and Visions to the World's Most Inexplicable Events. Whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.